Larry Summers on repealing the Bush tax cuts.
I don't think there's any question they have to be repealed. The country can't afford them for the long run.
Obama economics advisor Lawrence Summers on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday. In case you had any doubt about Obama's commitment to ending the Bush tax cuts for high earners, there had been some doubt. He seemed to lay that to rest. Chances are there will be no bipartisanship on that. But we will begin this hour with a strange bedfellows common ground segment on another big piece of economic policy, the TARP, the $700 billion bank bailout meant to unfreeze credit. We got press releases last week opposing the wisdom of the TARP from the progressive think tank, the Drum Major Institute, and the conservative think tank, the Manhattan Institute. And so we now have guests from both. Harry Moroz from the Drum Major Institute and themiddleclass.org. They've opposed TARP from day one. And Nicole Gelinas from the Manhattan Institute. She has a piece in their latest City Journal magazine called "Can the Feds Uncrunch Credit?" She says they could make the crisis much, much worse. Harry, welcome. Nicole, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks, Brian.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Harry.
And Harry, from the Drum Major Institute or the middleclass.org perspective, why have you been so down on the bank bailout known as TARP? What does it basically get wrong?
Well, essentially, we've looked at the TARP bailout from the middle class perspective, and we've looked at the real core issue for middle class Americans with respect to TARP, which we think is the foreclosure crisis. The original bailout we thought might address the foreclosure crisis, but there are no measures for accountability to hold lawmakers to task and the Treasury Department to task for addressing the crisis. We turned out to be right with the first use of the TARP 1 funds. And so when the Senate measure of disapproval came up last week, again, we supported that measure of disapproval. Right now, we're looking at 8.1 million more homes lost to foreclosure in the next 5 years. And the measures that have been put in place to protect against foreclosure just haven't functioned yet.
So at themiddleclass.org, do you look at it in class terms? Do you think it's welfare for the rich that leaves the middle class behind?
Yes, I think we are sort of tired of this narrow focus on Wall Street, especially when you have respected economists like Martin Feldstein and Joseph Stiglitz on the Charlie Rose show just last week, talking about how important it is to address the foreclosure crisis in order to address the financial crisis.
And Nicole, from your Manhattan Institute perspective, why have you been so skeptical about the TARP?
Well, it's absolutely true that the government needs to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to offset the severe credit contraction and asset deflation that we're seeing. But what they have been doing with the allocation, the half of it that they've already spent, is just really welfare for the failed. We've been putting capital into financial institutions whose leadership and institutional structure has proven to be incompetent and based on a failed business model. And the market continues to tell us that institutions like Citigroup simply should not be in existence. This government money, which is finite, should be spent making sure that the good assets and good businesses that can be salvaged from institutions like Citi, like AIG, and all of the others that have gotten these hundreds of billions of dollars in funding and loan guarantees, that these good assets are sold off to competent managers, no matter what the price. It's just important to get them in the hands of somebody that knows what to do with them. And the bad assets, the government is likely going to have to warehouse these for some time, just as the government does when it takes over failed commercial banks. But that's not important. What's important is not to have good businesses and assets locked up in the hands of people and institutions that failed miserably.
So if there had been no bank bailout, in your view, Nicole, where do you think we would be today? Because we kept hearing that saving Wall Street was needed to save Main Street, because a solvent banking system is needed for small business and consumer credit and for everyone's money to be worth anything. Where would Main Street be today without TARP 1, in your opinion?
Well, the way that we do need a bailout of the financial system. It's just a question of where are we putting the money. Mm-hmm. They have been trying to shore up the most complicated, you know, the original focus on buying toxic, complicated mortgage-backed assets from these financial institutions. That was not where to start. They should have started with what they eventually did do with part of this funding, which was guarantee things like money market funds, start putting government money into municipal bond money market funds, start at the foundations of the credit markets, not try to go to the top and save these institutions that failed. So absolutely, I would not argue that we should just do nothing and watch the entire financial system fail. Mm-hmm. That said, though, the financial system did fail. The government is now the financial system, and we might as well be honest about it and not pretend that that's not true, that we've somehow saved a private system. We haven't done that. We've replaced a private system with a government system, but we're just lying about it.
Harry, would you have let the banks just go down and put money into homeowner relief, foreclosure relief, and hope that was enough to shore up the banks from the bottom up?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily an either-or question. I think what Nicole and I would really agree on is the fact that if we're going to do a bailout like this, and if we're going to address the foreclosure crisis along with some of these necessary measures to shore up financial institutions, what we really need to have is accountability that means more than promises, more than even oversight and transparency. You know, disclosure of data is all fine and good, but what we really need is something like was involved with the auto bailout, where we saw the government demanding plans from the auto industry that were going to have actionable consequences if the auto industry did not live up to their plans.
Well, Harry, sure enough, in the view of many Democrats in Washington, TARP II, the second half of the $700 billion, which passed the Senate last week, will be better spent than TARP I because it's more targeted to help ordinary Americans and not just banks and comes with more accountability and strings. Here is Larry Summers again on Meet the Press explaining some of how.
The president's financial recovery program is going to be very different than what we've seen so far. It's going to emphasize transparency. It's going to emphasize accountability. Perhaps most importantly, the focus isn't going to be on the needs of financial institutions. Of course, we need to stabilize financial institutions. Without a stable financial system, the economy can't work. But the priority has to be getting credit flowing again so that people can buy cars, so that people can get mortgages, so that the economy will operate.
But, Harry, even with those changes, as laid out there by Larry Summers, for the Obama version of the TARP, your group opposed it.
Sure. I mean, bless Larry Summers' heart for saying what he did, but a promise is just as unenforceable after Obama's election as before. You know, the House passed a measure last week with the Barney Frank TARP reform bill that included some of these accountability measures. The Senate, on the other hand, decided not to do that. And, you know, I think what's really necessary is to have the force of law behind these promises. And Obama had called for the same, but then sort of went off and allowed the Senate to pass a carte blanche measure.
Nicole, what do you think of these differences between TARPs 1 and 2? And do you think for all the language that we heard from Larry Summers that it is actually another blank check?
Well, when he talks about stabilizing financial institutions, it is a losing game, as we should have learned over the past 18 months since the government started in October 2007. Trying to effectively hide these money-losing lending assets at the banks with the creation of the super-structured investment vehicle. That was the first attempt to do this, and we've continued right on until today. This is a losing game. The market understands that these institutions have failed. People will not put private dollars into an institution like Citi, like AIG. Keeping these institutions around in their current form is just prolonging the pain. The best best use of the second half of this $700 billion package would be to make sure that financial institutions that are, once they've sold these assets off to the government at today's prices, the ones that are insolvent are put out of their misery, that their good businesses are put in the hands of good financial institutions, which still exist. And that way, the good financial institutions aren't competing with failed zombie banks. If we don't do that, we will just prolong this. And when we do inevitably recover, the economy will be less competitive because the industry that does one of the most important jobs in the economy, which allocates is the allocation of credit, will be a government-guaranteed sort of collection of big failures.
One of the big disputes here has been the failure of TARP 1 to require banks to lend rather than just giving them the money and letting them use it to shore up their reserves or buy up other banks. But here is Summers again on Meet the Press defending the idea that allowing banks to hoard money might ultimately be good for credit.
It wouldn't be responsible for an institution that can't contain confidence, can't maintain any confidence right now, mm-hmm. to raise its lending without having capital.
So they need more money.
That's why there needs to be more capital in the system. That's right. Why this $350 billion is so important. Because of course the institutions need to lend more, but they need to lend more in a way that's consistent with their solvency, and that means that crucial is capital adequacy and increased lending. And that's why we focus on the flow of credit, and capital adequacy is part of what you do to maintain the flow of credit and permit the increased lending that I think everybody agrees that the economy requires.
That was an interesting answer. Nicole, I'd like to get your reaction first, because he's saying basically if a bank doesn't have a sound, fundamental store of cash reserves and the government is demanding that it lend money, then there's going to be more nervousness about the state of that bank and it's maybe more likely to collapse. So it's actually good for credit in the long run for the banks to rebuild their foundations of cash. Does that make common sense to you?
Absolutely. You have both the need to shore up financial capital and human capital at these institutions. We have to remember that for the past 10 years, and really 2 decades, this started 2 decades ago, banks haven't really been banks. They've just been paper creators and sellers. These banks didn't have experts in whether a person or a company could repay their loan based on fundamentals of the economy, of the person's own credit history and income, or of the business's own credit history and income. They were just making securities and selling them. And now they have to learn to do something completely different, and that has become old-fashioned banks again, and look at the fundamentals of the people who are borrowing money from them. And this can't be done overnight. This is kind of like, you know, when somebody goes to the hospital to have the baby, the hospital's job is to shepherd that process and let the mother and baby go home. If you ask the hospital to raise the baby until it's 18 years old, that's an entirely different job. And that's what the banks have to start doing now, is watching these loans over their 30-year life and not just over a few months until they've sold them off. And this change cannot be done overnight. This is a long process. There is no shortcut, and it will be very painful.
And Harry, that clip of Larry Summers was almost directly contradictory to the last one that we played, mm-hmm. where he was giving all the reasons why TARP 2 had to be different from TARP 1 and had to make sure that there was more money actually getting out to consumers and homeowners and students and others for their credit problems. Here, he seemed to say, yeah, it makes perfect sense that the banks need to build up their reserves so they can decide to start lending again. So maybe no wonder TARP 2 actually came out with no more strings attached than TARP 1, even though the language was different.
Sure. I mean, I really think that they sort of have no concrete idea still for what they want to do with these TARP 2 funds. I mean, I think they're still in a period of debate, and it's probably a useful one. What we need to see from TARP 2, or what we really needed to see, was was some sort of plan that would allow us to judge whether these, whether the Treasury Department, whether guys like Larry Summers are, whether their promises are being fulfilled, and whether the banks are fulfilling their promises. Now, if we say they're going to lend and they don't lend, then we need to consider measures where we take back our money.
I wonder, and my guests are Harry Moroz, research associate at the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy, and Nicole Gelinas, a fellow with the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor to its City Journal. She has an article about uncrunching the credit and whether the federal government can actually do that, about which she is skeptical. And this is kind of a common ground, strange bedfellows segment. Why do you think, from Harry, your progressive, and Nicole, your conservative orientation, that you reach many of the same conclusions, while the leaders of both parties supported the TARP in the forms in which it went out? I'm looking at a post on our webpage for this segment. KC from Manhattan writes, "I went to a protest on Wall Street during the passage of TARP. There were easily over 1,000 people there, libertarians, communists, and everything in between." So how does opposition to TARP fit in with your basic economic orientation or sense of right and wrong? Harry?
You know, I think where I step into the conversation probably with Nicole is that we started this conversation in the wrong place. We started talking about how we should save Wall Street and not how we should address the fundamental problem of the financial crisis, which is the foreclosure crisis. And as we've seen over the last 3 or 4 months, this foreclosure crisis has persisted, and the notion of the subprime borrower as the homeowner in foreclosure no longer applies. So we've had a broadening of this crisis. And so now we're left in a place where, again, we're still not addressing the fundamental problem. So I think it's really about the necessary debate that we started in the wrong place, and we still haven't gotten to a conversation where we're talking about the fundamental problems.
Nicole, same question.
Absolutely. I would concur that we started this discussion in the wrong place with this focus on how do we maintain the status quo of having these huge financial institutions continue to mindlessly increase their lending month after month after month, when that was absolutely not going to happen. And another fundamental question, which in the end comes down to conservative values of personal and institutional responsibility as well as competitiveness, is the fact that these big financial institutions failed. They built a business model that turned out to be a spectacular failure. That is not a failure of free markets. In fact, it's the free markets that eventually exposed this long, long run of crony capitalist financial institutions and their political stewards as abject failures. And certainly the government cannot let the free market complete this process so that you have decimation. You don't want to destroy the system in order to save it, but we do have to realize that the market is telling us something, that this model of ever-increasing debt, ever bigger, too big to fail financial institutions was a complete and total failure, and we cannot try to continue to prop up this system. It simply will not work. It's a losing game, and we will make the economy much worse off, even though that's hard to conceive of today.
All right. Harry, real quick.
Yeah, I would like to push back on Nicole's article. It's a wonderful article. It's really interesting, but I do think this notion that we can just allow organizations to fail without addressing the fundamental concerns of middle-class Americans is just not right. We need to address the real problem in the foreclosure crisis, and I think, you know, just sort of allowing the market to reorganize itself is not sufficient.
So some common ground and some not between Harry Moroz from the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy and themiddleclass.org and Nicole Gelinas from the Manhattan Institute and their City Journal. Thank you both very much for an important conversation.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks, Harry.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, we will meet the Consul General of Mexico on who's still immigrating to New York in a time of recession. and with a new administration, what Obama-Mexico relations might be like. And then counting people in the cold, we will preview tonight's New York City homeless census. Stay tuned.